Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Norris, Chief Research and Innovation Officer at Louisiana Tech University, and this is Beyond 1894, the Louisiana Tech University podcast. Now, way beyond 1894, in the year 2013, the Obama administration, through the National Science Foundation, launched the U.S. BRAIN Initiative. BRAIN is an acronym for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. The U.S. BRAIN Initiative is part of the International BRAIN Initiative, and it's taking a comprehensive approach to understanding the brain, which is the most complex biological structure on Earth, probably by a lot. And despite great advances in neuroscience over the decades, there's still much we just don't understand about the brain. And this BRAIN Initiative holds great promise for addressing fundamental neurobiological questions about how the brain works and how to treat it when it doesn't work. But also, as we understand the brain, because it's so sophisticated, the things that we learn about how the brain works can help us in developing other innovations and technologies and other aspects of society. It's probably a consensus in the scientific community that when we do ultimately figure out comprehensively how the brain works, however long it takes us to do that, that will probably be considered the greatest scientific achievement in human history. I'm here in our studio with Dr. Leon Isomedes. He is the Rhodes Eminent Scholar Chair in Biomedical Engineering at Louisiana Tech University. He is the director of the Center for Biomedical Engineering and Rehabilitation Science. He is a fellow in the American Institute of Medical and Biological Engineers. He is a fellow in the National Academy of Inventors. And he's also been nominated and selected by his international peers as a fellow to the IEEE, which is the world's largest technical professional organization for the advancement of technology for humanity. The IEEE fellow status is the highest level of membership conferred by the IEEE on persons with, quote, extraordinary records of scientific accomplishments. Dr. Isomedes is considered one of the founders of the field of seizure prediction and control. He's collaborated on this work with the Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Barrow Neurological Institute, among others. Leon, thank you for being here this morning and welcome.
Thank you, Davey.
So your work, since you started your graduate studies at the University of Michigan, has been on the leading edge of neuroscience and trying to understand how the brain works. Can you give us a sense, just what have you learned, what have we learned in the scientific community about how the brain works, and what do we still need to learn? What do we not know?
Well, it was challenging when I started, and it's still challenging now. Yeah. So over all these years, 30-plus years, what we know about the brain, we have gathered from animal experiments and from patients with diseases that need to be cured. So the BRAIN Initiative, as you mentioned, that was launched about 8 years ago, and there is funding for five more years, it struggles to understand better how the brain operates, and in particular, the brain, the diseased brain, and the normal, the healthy brain. The implications of that to our life and technology are huge. So what we know up to this point is the neural networks, how they are constructed, and how they operate at basis, at the macroscopic basis. But what we lack for sure at this point is how they operate on at a global level when they are coordinate to execute particular operations. Either these are sensing and or motor control and so on. So there's a lot of areas that we have to concentrate and advance. And in general, I think that we are looking at a horizon of 50 years from now.
So we understand at a micro level what little micro sections of the brain are doing and how they work. But then at a network or at a system scale, the whole brain, that's where we're really struggling to put all that together systematically.
Right. So I would say structurally, how the brain is consists of and composed of, we have a pretty good picture, but how functionally, what kind of operations, when they coordinate, what kind of critical operations they execute is a matter of research, especially for the cognition, for memory, and a higher is what we say, what we call a higher level functions.
Mm-hmm. So you made reference to things we learn from looking at a healthy brain and then different things we learn from looking at a brain that's not functioning normally or healthily. You're the lead scientist on the NeuroNIM project, which is a $6 million National Science Foundation funded project based here at Louisiana Tech, and it's part of the National Brain Initiative. Tell us about NeuroNIM and kind of where it fit. What are you working on and where does it fit in the big picture?
NeuroNIM stands for Neuronal Networks in Epilepsy and Memory. And when we applied for that grant, obviously we had some preliminary results over the years. So what we were missing, and we wanted to have support from NSF, from National Science Foundation on that, was look how our macroscopic findings would correlate with microscopic findings. So we asked for funds to look at the brain at the microscopic level dynamically, however, how the microscopic operations evolve over time, and this we would accomplish by recordings from the brain of animals and people over time, over long time, as we call it, longitudinal data that we're going to have over days and months, continuously recordings of the electrical and magnetic activity of the brain, and relate that to concurrent microscopic recordings of molecules that we can detect with specific electrodes that are sensors, I would say, that we developed here at Louisiana Tech. So this is a collaboration with of three universities where the lead in this NeuroNIM consortium, and other universities are the University of Arkansas and the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
It's a big medical center there.
It's a big medical center. So the other, as you said, David, these are the medical centers, and they provide human data to us.
And we're the engineers.
Yes, in particular patients with epilepsy, recordings from them, as we call it, electroencephalographic and magnetoencephalographic recordings. When they perform tests, different memory tests, also when they experience seizures, epileptic seizures, the faculty is about 20 faculty members in all three institutions that are involved in this big project, and about 40 undergraduate and graduate students. And we're on the fourth year for this on this grant.
So just backing up a little bit, that neuroscience, neurotransmitters, neuromodulation, neurons. Early 20th century, a Spanish neuroscientist, Santiago Ramón y Cajal, draws these branching tree-like structures of neurons. In 1906, he wins a Nobel Prize. It was kind of the world's first view of what these cells of the brain look like. And now we have modern microscopes and robotics and machine learning and all that stuff. So we're developing this much more sophisticated image of what the brain looks like, kind of like the Human Genome Project. This we call it the connectome or something, the map of the brain. Are we ever going to have, when are we going to have a complete picture of what the brain really looks like, the way we have a picture of the human genome?
At this point in time, in huge laboratories, medical laboratories, as you said, they are working on the connectome for the brain of Drosophila fly, and they are pretty sure that they will develop the complete map of about 100,000 neurons that the brain consists of in this fly in about 2 years. Then they're talking about
100,000 neurons in the brain of a fruit fly.
Yes.
How many neurons in the brain of a human?
80 to 100 billion neurons.
That's a lot.
This is a lot, and they, I would speculate. However, things are accelerating. So after they develop, and they have all the, as you said, the automated process now with new techniques to image the different layers of the brain in place. So I think that took $50 million for them to do, and they're going to develop $500 million for the next brain, which more probably is going to be the brain of the mouse. This
so we're moving up the scale, getting bigger.
Moving up the scale. So I would say in the next two or three decades, that would be possible. But I have to point out here that these are images which are static, and the dynamics of the connectome are not addressed through this process. And the dynamics, how they collaborate over time, how they change, how they adapt, is a bigger, let's say, task. Mm. And that was my original pole of attraction for me, for my research. So we concentrate mostly in the dynamics.
So you grew up in Athens, Greece. Athens is sort of this iconic city in the history of Western civilization, birthplace of the academy, the university, study of history and philosophy, mathematics, physics, engineering. And the remnants of all that and those characters are still in that city, and you grew up there. And so as a child, you become attached to science, to learning, to physics. How'd you end up evolving from that to where you are today? How did Dad feel about theoretical physics?
Right. So actually, as far as I remember, it was my mom who was also always asking the question why in anything that I was telling her. And that she instilled in me that question, anything that I was learning. So the physics was something that attracted me at most, because I thought, and I still think, that this is the science that sets the foundation and the questions of why things are the way they are and how they work. And then biology came into place in my last year of the undergraduate studies, where in Greece there are 5 years of engineering. In the last year, we do what we call here the senior design project. So my senior design project at that time was had to do with speech, the human speech processing. And that was my first encounter with real biological signals. I loved it, and I knew that a combination of physics, engineering, and biology would be my best joy in life, actually, because obviously that's a kind of saying that you have to love what you're doing job-wise so that you are happy, and I'm still happy.
And engineering is a little stronger path from your dad's perspective than physics, right? Because you can get a job.
Dad was always concerned about
getting you off the payroll. That's dad's main job in the world, right?
And he was worried about my success in life, also financially and so on.
Follow your passion, but get off my payroll as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Right. So he proposed he understood my quests and curiosities and so on. So he proposed engineering as a kind of compromise, and electrical engineering in particular, because they had to do with physics more, physics and signals and so on. So I graduated with an electrical engineering degree, And then I pursued postgraduate studies in USA.
Tell me about you. You skipped over your movie producing career.
Yeah. Well, I had multiple interests, more into music and humanities and so on. I had a private illegal radio station at that time in Greece. All private stations were illegal because we were in the era of the dictatorship in Greece when I was growing up. And then also my interests were also in movies and cinema directorship and this kind of.
Google any of your movies on YouTube or Netflix or anything I could look up?
Not really.
No.
Not really. At that time, I never continued along this route because I got very busy with school and I wanted to succeed. So that took a lot of my free time.
But you were fascinated by human interaction and relationships.
Exactly.
That's in humanities in the movies, but it's also in the work you ended up.
Yeah. So you can say that I'm fascinated with how neurons in the brain collaborate for a particular common goal, and then how humans do the same thing. Right. So I was really attracted by this, and I really wanted to see how humans communicate and what is the optimal ways to communicate right. So I wanted to produce movies along these lines and see how human society would be at a better stage, more happier, and so on. I was intrigued by that. I wanted to produce movies along these lines.
So you get from Athens to Brown University, to Michigan, to Florida, to Arizona, to Louisiana. You have a position at Louisiana Tech that's kind of interesting. Our former president, Dan Reneau, started one of the nation's first biomedical engineering programs here at Louisiana Tech, and the university was very much identified with that. And in the process, he helped build the research enterprise at the university, and that biomedical engineering program was by its nature very interdisciplinary, and you're the director of CBERS, the Center for Biomedical Engineering and Rehab Science, and that's where the NeuroNIM project is based. So you work on some very complex science, extremely sophisticated techniques, tools. These are all difficult, challenging questions that take years and years to really make progress and try to resolve. Try to boil that down to a listener and how your work on the brain impacts people's lives, people with epilepsy, people with traumatic brain injury or stroke or other neurological conditions. How is that impacting or impacts people's lives?
So my personal research focuses on dynamics of the brain, and epilepsy is an ideal disorder because there are what we call seizures. Epileptic seizures are transitions of the brain function into a pathology and then recovery. So from the right beginning, I was intrigued and attracted by the ability of the brain to recover. And of course, there are many questions there, like which area of the brain starts to become pathologic, because this kind of important for the treatment, for diagnostic purposes. And then over time, if we can develop a warning of an upcoming seizure, and then what are actually seizures themselves, so what chemicals in the brain they produce so that the brain would recover, what we have called the resetting of the brain function. So there are questions of diagnostic and treatment after, for example, you are able to predict that is going to be happening within the next 1 hour, then you can you have enough time to intervene.
Work, you want to be able to predict when a seizure is coming before it comes and then intervene in some way that prevents that seizure.
Exactly. So the modern science, neuroscience, they can intervene through electrical or magnetic stimulation, or you can intervene through increase of a drug dose if you have enough time, and avert a seizure from happening. So this is what what is called neuromodulation. So you can modulate, mainly you are able to modulate the neuronal networks and avert their synchronization that happens much before a seizure. That's what we find, and then the seizure would not happen.
You spent a big part of your career working on epilepsy and seizures, right? And it seemed like you just described the impact of your work is relevant certainly for epileptic seizures, but because you're studying the brain going from normal functioning to, I think, what you described as pathology to some recovery back to normal functioning, that process is something that's relevant for all kinds of brain conditions or functioning, right? Because you're going from normal to pathology to recovery. So it's not just relevant for epilepsy or seizures.
So we have to point out here that actually epilepsy or somebody that who may have epileptic seizures, may the pathology, this may be an epiphenomenon of an underlying other pathology, like epileptic seizures may develop from patients with stroke, after stroke, or with cancer, or with traumatic brain injury. So in that sense, it's really very any findings that we are going to find in this area could be applicable to multiple of other brain disorders. Actually, lately, they have discovered that Alzheimer's patients, they do have seizures that they were not able to identify before. And then a new area for scientific investigations is an overlap between epilepsy and Alzheimer's. And many resources are now started to be devoted to this new kind of field, research field. So, and this is the attractive field for this area of epilepsy, that it overlaps so many other brain disorders.
So you've founded or co-founded a couple of companies in the area of neuromodulation in an effort to help ensure that the benefits of your work get out into the commercial market and impact people's quality of life and health. You've co-authored four awarded, one pending, 9 provisional patents. I may not have all those numbers right, but there's a lot of intellectual property generated around this, and your goal is to help get that out into the commercial market. Tell us a little bit about the products or methods that you hope get out into the commercial market from your work.
Yeah, so two main products at this point. One has to do with prediction well ahead of seizures. So it's a software that works by analyzing signals from the brain, electrical signals like EEG or magnetic signals like MEG, and it gives warning of an impending seizure. And the second product is also a software that a diagnostic software that can diagnose where the focus, the what we call epileptogenic focus, that is the area of the brain that is responsible, is pathological, and responsible for the development of seizures, to be able to localize this region in the brain by non-invasive recordings like magnetoencephalography. And the new thing there is that without a patient having seizures, without the patient having to have seizures, so that to localize the focus that is during the seizure-free periods, which
so
is
the idea
very challenging.
Is a non-invasive method that identifies where a seizure is coming from in the brain without having to have a seizure.
Yes.
And the alternative to that is deep penetration into the brain with a neuro stimulator or some kind of sensor. And you have to have a seizure.
Right. So as you said, The alternative is for the patient to be in what we call epilepsy monitoring unit for 1 week and have seizures, and a couple of typical one seizures, and the doctors would see which area of the brain is leading the discharges. And the other alternative is to implant a neurostimulator, which, as you said, is not only stimulator, but usually it's a sensor too. And that would be a long-term that has the capability of recordings also.
It goes down into the brain.
It goes into the brain and stays there for months or years. And in this case, you do have a lot of data from the patient, and you can identify hopefully where the focus is going to be. And this is very important because you can remove the focus by surgery, and the surgeon should really know where is the focus, which may be different per patient, so that to remove it, and ideally also know the network of the focus, as we call it, the epileptic epileptogenic network. This is important diagnostic question, and the seizure prediction is a very important part of treatment.
So you also have a lot of interaction with students, and you teach classes somehow.
Yes.
In between all this, I heard that you were recently selected by the students for a very prestigious award related to your teaching. Can you tell us all just mm-hmm. a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I teach undergraduate and graduate courses. And a few weeks ago, I got a surprise. The Alpha, Eta, Mu, Beta Society of Biomedical Engineers students. Which is a national biomedical engineering society that actually our ex-president, Don Renault, helped establish, and he was the first president of the society. And that was about 1979.
So this is one of the oldest student organizations
right.
on campus.
That was 1979, yeah. As the oldest biomedical engineering societies too. So these are 50 years, 51 years now for the society. So they do have annual galas and so on. So in the latest one, they surprised me with an award, and the award was saying most likely to keep you in class late.
most likely to talk too long in the lecture. Okay, likely to keep you in class late.
Which is true. I really like the students to be, to give to the students as much material and knowledge as possible. Uh-huh. Usually, 15 minutes late.
15 minutes, that's no problem. It's plenty of time. Now, is that because you're not watching the clock, or is that because you're just too into it and you just keep on going? Do you know you're going over time?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay. Now,
but I have warned them. I have warned them. Actually, one of the first questions I ask when the course starts is, okay, who has other class after this one?
Because you might be late.
And accordingly, I decide how many minutes would be.
Well, on the Beyond 1894 podcast, we do not go over time. And so we're gonna wrap this up, and greatly appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us. Thank you for all the work that you do. For the work you do with our students and the impact you're having on people's lives. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond 1894. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us. It will help others find our podcast. If you would like to learn more about today's guest or find details about the episode, check out our show notes. To find our podcast webpage, go to 1894.lawtech.edu/beyond. If you have suggestions for future episodes, email us at 1894@lawtech.edu. We would love your input, so tell us what you want to hear. Beyond 1894 is produced by the Office of University Communications, with help from the Wagner Center and the School of Music at Louisiana Tech University. Dave Norris is the executive producer. I, Amy Bell, am the producer and the chief editor. And the music featured was arranged by Kalis Ash.